Hello. I would like to do nothing and invite you to do nothing too all day. My life happens with such velocity, and there's so much that I do that is the result of habit and oops. I've seen this happen before.
That happens to all the teachers.
And can you hear it? And I come to the Zendo, to the temple, because it's a place where I can let go of all that busyness in my mind and in my life. And more and more, I'm really drawn to the idea and the activity of doing nothing. Sometimes doing nothing is thought of in terms of phrases like the Taoist phrase Wu Wei, and it's the idea of bringing our activity into accord with the situation and the causes and conditions just as they exist, and nothing more, just leaving it at that, which is a nice way of thinking about doing nothing. Leaving myself alone is another nice way of thinking about doing nothing. And it's a little bit more active, a little less oriented toward thinking. Leaving the self alone, just letting it be. Doing nothing is also a place. This is a place, a space that is sometimes thought of as being liminal, right? It's a place of transition. It's an in-between place. The idea of some spaces being liminal is a rather recent one. It was first developed by a Dutch-French ethnologist. There it goes again. Ethnologist who in the 1900s wanted a way to describe those states people enter into that are sort of in between states, the rites of passage. And their rites of passage spaces, liminal spaces, are often characterized by ceremony and rituals, and much like we experience here in the temple. We come into this kind of ritualized space where we sit on black cushions and assume a posture of the Buddha in order to actualize our true selves. And I find it rather clearly a place that's in between. It's kind of coming from the world and all of its affairs that I'm very preoccupied with into this space where something might happen. And sometimes I'm a little impatient. I think, you know, I want something to clearly happen. And I sometimes think that, you know, I'm kind of made to desire something to happen, and I want this activity to occur, this awakening activity, this awakening within an awakening world activity. And I find myself maybe dealing with my posture and realizing that as I'm settling as we've been doing this morning, settling into samadhi, that my posture is not quite correct. Not, I had this idea of correct posture in Zazen, and part of it is that the tip of the tongue touches the roof of the mouth and stops saliva from collecting, and so you're not swallowing. I wasn't having none of that this morning. My mouth was not cooperating. It was like it was excreting and wanting to be swallowed, you know. And I thought, well, let me see if I can readjust the tip of my tongue and reshape the interior of the roof of my mouth so I don't swallow, because I might disturb Cody, right? These are the thoughts I have. And I think sometimes maybe I'm alone with these thoughts, and then I talk to people and realize I'm not, or I read something and realize I'm not. And one of the things I read recently is in Entering the Mind of Buddha, a book by Reb Anderson, which you might be familiar with. On page 45, Reb talks about the physical experience of Zazen, and he confesses that he's sitting all the time. He's sitting on long retreats, short retreats, at different times during his day. And there are times when he becomes impatient with himself because his posture is off. And so he pulls up his rib cage and elongates his body and holds it. And then maybe it folds away underneath him again. And he wishes to be sitting upright and not force uprightness on himself. But he confesses that he feels like he's forcing himself to sit upright. And that's something else I think I bring in to the Zendo with me when I come to sit, is that kind of self-reflecting and sort of critical idea about what Zazen is, what Buddhism is, what enlightenment is, etc. And today, I'm inviting us to abandon all those ideas and all those thoughts and relax. Just be lazy about your practice if you wish. Stop trying. I'm going to stop trying. I'm trying to stop trying. I'm putting a lot of effort into not trying. And I prepared to come today to espouse the virtues of not trying. Reb goes on to say that he wishes to not force himself because it's controlling himself. And bodhisattvas, he says, do not control others, and they don't control themselves. It's just really an eye-opening thing to realize for me, that I'm not here to control myself, and I'm not here to control you, for sure. I am here, it's to inquire into reality, in the nature of reality, that this reality that we share. And I love the lines from the precepts verse on the back of my Rakusu. There it is again. That from which the line was drawn, that is acting as the theme for sitting today. In front of the door is the land of stillness and light. How beautiful is that? I get what that's all about immediately. I'm sure you do too. I just step outside. I go to my door and open the door in the morning to step outside, and that's it. It's very clear. There's nothing that needs to be added or taken away. It's fully realized. Everything, the stillness, the light, and we can think of it in different ways. We can think of the door as being kind of right here at the tip of the nose, right? We can think of the land being this land or Buddha lands, the lands where everything is supporting us and giving us this great opportunity to awaken, and the stillness, meditation, samadhi, of course, and the light, pure cognition, the experience of being alive. It's the threshold of being alive. That doorway is the threshold of our lives. And the next line, spring comes, grass grows by itself, is a reminder to not manipulate myself, not try to control myself or others or anything in the world. Just leave it alone, leave it alone, leave it alone. It's a place of pure possibility. Existential, experiential, pure possibility. This liminal space, this in-between place in which anything can occur and does, and everything occurs. I was recently at a dinner with a fellow you may know, and not name dropping here. I just met him for the first time and had dinner with him and his wife, Linda Hess, who is more my friend. She's a poet. She's translated the poetry of Kabir. She is a frequent flyer at No Abode, where Rev teaches, as am I. And she invited me to come over and meet, as she put it, the great old man of Dogen. Her husband, Kazuaki Tanahashi, has translated a lot of Dogen. He's the number of books you'll out there by Kaz. And had a lovely time with him and Linda. And at one point, I asked him if he had an archive for all of his writings, teachings. He's a wonderful, he's a world famous calligrapher, artist, as well as a translator of Dogen, and an activist as well. And I asked about an archive, and he said, "No, I'm a creative thinker." He's not a teacher. Doesn't say I'm a calligrapher, artist, translator. He's a creative thinker. That's who he is. And this creative thinker, in one of his books, says that he's lazy, and that makes him very effective. So you can chew on that for a while, right? How's being lazy make you more effective? Well, in his case, he translated all these works by Dogen, and his calligraphy is in museums everywhere. He was working on a series of calligraphic pieces that were, he said, like conundrums and related to koans. So there's, this great translator of Dogen, lazy, and that makes him effective. There's Reb, looking into his realizing he's not going to sit beyond the limit of his patience, because he wants to be really available to people and helpful, and so he doesn't want to be impatient. He's not going to sit past that point where he's no longer feeling patient with himself. And then there are, there's the Buddha himself. We're all familiar with the story of Buddha's awakening. Sitting beneath the Bodhi tree, long, hard sitting, the morning star appears, he awakens and has this realization. And the part about the awakening of the Buddha that appeals to me most right now, that resonates most with me, is where the Buddha is practicing with the five friends, the ascetics, and really they're punishing their bodies, trying to sort of, in effect, dominate their egos, their egotism, and their desire to control. And he's thinking that it's not helping. He's not reaching enlightenment. He's not awakening as a result of these very hardships, these very harsh ascetic practices. And then he remembers a time when he was a boy and he was taken by his father to the fields for a plowing ceremony. And all of the men from all the villages and all the women went there, and the Buddha was a young boy who had nurses, and the nurses got really interested in the plowing ceremony, so they left the boy alone. And he realized at one point that he was alone in this grove of trees beneath a rose apple tree. And he looked out at, in one story, telling the story, he looks out at the field and he sees the field plowed up, and he can see the insects and their nests destroyed by the plowing, and he feels sorrow, and he describes the sorrow as being like the sorrow you would feel for the death of a family member. And he but it's a beautiful day. It's a gorgeous day, and like today, and he's in this quiet and fully alert, and he sits up in it and kind of naturally assumes the posture of a yogi, sitting posture, and experiences the jhanas, the first jhana. So he's alert and he's aware, and it's something that would not have occurred had the nurses remained there, presumably. They would have been chatting and talking and distracting him from everything, so he wouldn't have had this experience. But he does have it, and he's appreciative of the his isolation, the quietude, the quietness that he's experiencing. And he feels joy and calm and ease. And the Buddha, who is thinking about this boyhood, is in the grip of these ascetic practices that are tormenting his body and himself. And he thinks, maybe that's not the way to go. Maybe I should try to do something like I experienced back there under the rose apple tree. It's interesting that the story goes on to say that all of nature kind of reveled in the young Gautama's experience. And as the day wore on, the shadows lengthened on all the trees in the grove, except for the rose apple tree, which continued to keep its shadow over the Buddha and kind of protect the Buddha and keep him in the shade out of this harsh sunlight. So there's all of that, right? That I want to bring into this liminal space today, where pure possibility exists, where transformation might occur. It's, I think, well worth remembering that there are these great teachers in the Buddha himself reminding us that this place of joy and calm and letting go of the egotistical self, the small self, is where the practice is, not where maybe I want to focus it or try to focus it. I want to try to not focus it. I really want to be open to the possibilities of this moment and the next moment in my life and in my body and in my mind and in my consciousness. So I say, let's do nothing together today and just sort of investigate this. It's a teaching also that, like the robe verse, we're all familiar with the robe verse that says that we put on this robe, and it's the teaching of the Tathagata, right? And on the back of my raka suit, my robe, this is the symbolic robe of the Buddha, it says, it's a verse written by my teacher's teacher, Zen master Sung San, the Korean Zen master who founded the Kwannon School of Zen. And he would write this on paper initially when people were receiving the precepts. He would give them this poem that pretty much condenses his teaching and appreciation of the Buddha Dharma in essence. And I think it also really expresses very nicely the entirety of the Buddha's teachings throughout the canonical texts, you know, and Zen and Tibetan Buddhism, all of it. It goes, good and evil are without self-nature. Enlightenment and unenlightenment are empty names. In front of the door is the land of stillness and light. Spring comes, grass grows by itself. There's another approach also involving the robe to this lesson I'm trying to teach myself. It's one of our Zen stories, koan stories, or just a story. I think it's the 21st patriarch in the Soto lineage tree. Nangshan Wan Guan and Tonghan are the two characters in the story. And Liangshan is the attendant to Tonghan. And Tonghan is entering the Dharma hall and needs his robe. So Liangshan brings him the robe, and Tonghan says to Liangshan, "What is the business beneath the robe?" And Liangshan doesn't answer, can't answer. So Tonghan says, "Now you ask me." And Liangshan asks Tonghan, "What is the business beneath the robe?" And Tonghan says, "Intimacy." At this place, this liminal place we've entered into for a day, is a place of great intimacy. What that intimacy is for each of us to discover, and there's no one here, least of all me, who can instruct you. You have to find out, we each have to find out for ourselves what that intimacy is. There's another piece to this story that I'd like to share, because it involves Dongshan, who is the, you know, the first in this long succession, in the Soto succession, first ancestor. And many people began asking this question, what is the business beneath the robe, of different teachers? And at one point, Dongshan asks a student, you know, what is this? He asks a different question, but it's related. He asks, what is the most painful thing you can experience? What is the most painful experience? And the student says, hell, being in hell, any kind of hell, is the most painful experience. And Dongshan says, no. Wearing the robe and not clarifying the great matter is the most painful, right? Coming into a place like this, starting a practice of Zen, Zazen, meeting with teachers, making friends, reading the scriptures, meditating, and not clarifying this great matter is painful. You know, how do we clarify this great matter? Is the question I feel is being asked by this koan. Intimacy. And I recently realized, talking with a friend, that my idea of this intimacy is too much an idea of intimacy, not directly experienced. It's not practice realization of intimacy. It was an idea, an abstraction, a name, some words to be exchanged. And when I'm in that place, again, another liminal place, I find it very dreamlike. You know, we talk about our experience of reality being dreamlike. For me, more and more, maybe for you too, that dreamlike experience is the experience of separation from anything, whatever there is here, right now, in this room, at this moment. And not to be caught and stay in that dreamlike state is the work of this liminal space where this radical transformation can occur, where one, it's hoped, my hope is, we will directly experience that intimacy. And it's with everything or anything that comes up. It happens out in the world when we're busy looking at our devices, and when we walk in here and sit down and wish to be quiet and still. The intimacy is occurring all the way through those experiences, right here. The intimacy is right here, right now. And it's calling to us to not fall, kind of prey to experiencing it as a dream, to really experience vividly throughout our bodies and minds this moment of clarity. So it's like we sometimes say, it's like clear water, you know, all the way down to the bottom, looking into clear water all the way down to the bottom. And it's embodied. There's no way our perceptions, our thoughts, our conceptualizations are going to even get close to the intimacy that's being pointed to by the koan. And everything I say right now, of course, is going to be very much beside the point and lead us all astray, because they're just more words, and I like words too much. I picked the Zazengi today, and I hope you'll revisit it if you get a chance during the day, because it speaks to this very experience of this liminal space. This is a description that Dogen offers of this transformational place in our practice. And every paragraph he's urging us to step forward to the leading edge of our experience. If you want to attain suchness, practice suchness immediately. It's very clear. In front of the door is the land of stillness and light. If you want to attain suchness, just practice suchness immediately. I forgot to say something earlier that I'm going to go circle back to for one moment. This idea, it may be helpful to you, it was helpful to me. This idea of activity and non-activity is something that we pivot between. And I don't recommend rejecting one or clinging to the other, no attachment to either one or rejection of either one, but just pay attention to how it occurs. The going to activity is something common to our lives. We're born into this culture and this world at a time when there's nothing but this going to activity, doing this, doing that, thinking your way to school, or going through relationships, just doing, doing, doing. It's all activity. We don't much accentuate the inactivity and the coming from inactivity. This is a place today where I hope we can all begin to practice or pay more attention to the coming from inactivity. It's a dichotomy. It's a self-contradiction, right? But if you sit with it, some interesting stuff might occur. This doing, drop the doing, we're always doing, going into activity, and pay attention to the place of inactivity into no activity, or the activity of no activity, and try to come from there into the experiential world that we're in today, this Dharma hall, talking with each other, being with each other. It's not a place we're familiar with, not an easy practice to do, and maybe it can't be done. In fact, I think it's rather inconceivable. But, look into it. See what you find. That's it. Thank you.